Hello, this is the Chasing Society podcast, and today we are going to talk about Georg Simmel's text, The Metropolis and the Mental Life. So you walk through a big city, like a really big city. Think New York, Berlin, Stockholm. Well, maybe Stockholm doesn't really fit in. Anyhow, you walk through a big city, and what do you see? How do people behave? What do people do? There's a good chance that you will find a lot of indifference. You will see people minding their own business, leaving each other alone. They may be in close proximity to each other. They may be in a subway, which is really crowded and packed with people, and yet everybody's doing their own stuff, looking at their phone. Many may have their headphones on and listen to music or podcasts or whatever. But they basically live a indifferent coexistence, not much interaction. And it seems as if everybody would be fine with that. This is how things are done in the metropolis. When you read Georg Simmel's text about the metropolis and the mental life, you will feel that this text could have been written quite recently, because his description of the metropolis is quite accurate, and my students tend to identify with what he's saying, and they tend to relate to the experiences that Simmel is describing in this text. So it would appear then that Simmel, despite this text being quite old, has still something to say about how we lead our lives in the 21st century. So let's have a closer look at his arguments and his descriptions of the metropolis and the mental life. So the first thing that I want to point out is that this text, even though it is called The Metropolis and the Mental Life, it extends to a broader description of culture. So this text nicely aligns itself with many claims that Simmel is making with regard to culture in previous and later texts. Also keep in mind that when Simmel is talking about the metropolis, he is actually to a large extent talking about modernity as such. Urbanization, the Industrial Revolution, and what we call modernity are closely related. At the same time, it is important to point out that the metropolis that Simmel is talking about is most likely Berlin. Berlin. By that time, it was the capital of the German Empire. It was an industrial city, and it was a representative of modernity. In the 1850s, roughly 500,000 people lived in Berlin, which was already quite a lot. But in 1913, it was 4 million. This was an insane population growth, and it was this type of population growth that concerned already Emil Durkheim in the Division of Labor and Society. A metropolis like Berlin is a different social ecosystem. It is qualitatively different from other social environments, and it is a particularly modern, unique form of living together, this huge city with millions of people living there. This is something that creates a different environment which affects people in a number of ways. And Simmel wants to explore the ways in which this new environment affects people, and he does that in this text. So let's explore his findings. We can start with what might be considered the most catchy term that Simmel is presenting in this text, and that is the blasé attitude. So what Simmel describes is that the urban life has created its own cognitive, primarily, attitude. And this attitude shows in a number of ways. He calls it the blasé attitude, and I think we can start from its characterization as something that creates a distance between people. Because this is something that my students point out as very relatable when we read this text today and when we discuss it. So the blasé attitude means that people distance themselves from each other. Not physically, of course. Quite ironically, the physical distance between people can be if we're not living in a pandemic, that is, of course, it can be quite close, like a very crowded place in the metropolis, or let's say a subway in rush hour. People are packed in these places. So there is no way that the blasé attitude could possibly mean that people distance themselves from each other physically, as we currently do in this pandemic. The point is that in the face of this physical proximity, people distance themselves emotionally from each other. So the blasé attitude describes a distance in closeness, so to speak. A bit like a description of the stranger that Sybil provides elsewhere. So the blasé attitude means that we can endure an ongoing physical closeness because we have erected some form of distance, emotional distance from each other that allows us to be or remain strangers in physical close proximity. So what Sybil then adds to that is that the pure fact that human beings are so overwhelmed with impressions, with not only people, but also noise or light. I mean, consider standing at Piccadilly Circus in London, or at Times Square, or at any famous place from a metropolis, which is known for its like lights and people and crowds and everything. So this constant confrontation with stimuli, as Sybil calls them, this constant confrontation has basically, in his view, created this blasé attitude. This is a protective tool. It's a protective shield, so to speak, against this overstimulating environment. So this is a very materialistic argument, if you will. Sybil is saying that the sheer quality of the place, its overstimulating character, is causing people to protect themselves from this stimulation. This is, as I said, very materialistic. It's basically the place, the material aspects of the place, be that noise, be that light, be that people or bodies or whatever you want to look at, all of these taken together create this overstimulating environment, which creates this need for people to protect themselves against it. So Sybil also seems to have a very clear idea that human beings cannot take a ton of stimulation at the same time. They need to filter. And the metropolis is a place that is too much. It is unfiltered. And therefore, humans have developed this shield, this blasé attitude, which protects them from this overstimulation and which creates an artificial filter against the stimulation. So this is the first part, but this does not exhaust the concept of the blasé attitude. It entails a number of more interesting aspects. The second most important one, I would say, is the tendency of the metropolis to be a place which predominantly operates on the intellectual level. So Sybil adds to the blasé attitude that this is an attitude that intellectualizes the world. This is deeply connected to this protective mechanism against overstimulation. Sybil believes that in order to handle the environment that humans are put in the metropolis, it is easier for us to approach it from the mental, cognitive, intellectual plane, rather than from the emotional, affective plane of the body. Now, what you can tell or what you can see here in this distinction is a distinction that has run through the Western world and the philosophy of the Western world since many, many hundreds of years, at least, if not longer. That is the idea that there's a distinction between the mental, the cognitive, the brain, if you will, and the body and emotions that come from the body, the passions, I think, is the word that many empiricists have used. So there's the intellect and there are the passions. And these are two distinct realms of human existence. And modernity, by means of urbanization, for example, puts an emphasis on the intellectual aspects of human life. And it downplays the importance, or it removes the importance of the passionate bodily aspects of human life. So in my interpretation of the text, intellectual does not mean superiority. Like when we speak of intellectual people, we usually tend to assign some sort of, this person is smarter than me or knows more than me or something like that. If you're an intellectual person, it's usually meant to be a compliment of someone who is very educated, for example, and knows stuff. But in my interpretation of Simmel's text, I don't see him making just that assignment. I think what Simmel is trying to point out with this term intellectualism or intellectual attitude or intellectualization, as he sometimes also calls it in different texts, what he means by that is a general emphasis of the of human existence on the mental and the cognitive capacities, that life is predominantly happening on the cognitive plane of human existence. So one thing which indicates that my interpretation might be correct is that Simmel points out that one of the clearest signs of the urban intellectualism is the money economy, or the way in which money works in human and for human interaction. So this is a claim that he will lay out in greater detail in other texts, and especially in The Philosophy of Money. But he already indicates the importance of money in modern culture, or for modern culture, in his view. So the claim that he's making is basically that money is a manifestation of a general tendency of modern urban life. And that is this tendency to objectify and quantify things, even in human relations. This makes it possible to relate to them in intellectual ways, let's say in terms of calculation. So in the same way in which money makes it possible to calculate the price of goods and products, it also contributes to this general blasé attitude that wants to treat the external environment not as a qualitative, colorful spring of impressions, but as a, let's say, a grayscale background of human existence. So as I said previously, the blasé attitude was meant to protect us from this overstimulation of the environment. And the blasé attitude is therefore creating the same type of approach to the world as such that money creates when it comes to market interaction. So we treat other people more or less with the same distance, the same claim towards objectivity, calculability, and measurability that we have established in the marketplace. And Simmel is even not sure which one came first. He writes this very explicitly. So he says that, furthermore, this psychological intellectualistic attitude and the money economy are in such close integration that no one is able to say whether it was the former that affected the latter or vice versa. But what we know, according to Simmel, is, quote, the money economy and the domination of the intellect stand in the closest relationship to one another. They have in common a purely matter-of-fact attitude in the treatment of persons and things, in which a formal justice is often combined with an unrelenting hardness. The purely intellectualistic person is indifferent to all things personal, because out of them relationships and reactions develop, which are not to be completely understood by purely rational methods. Now, this is a quite prophetic excerpt from Simmel's text, because it seems to predict what, for example, smartphone apps like Tinder are doing when they match people to each other in terms of collected characteristics of their personality, and then people can swipe them away or accept the match and continue from there. This is basically what Simmel predicts in this text, or describes in this text. He doesn't really predict it. He says that the metropolitan attitude is already here, of course. But it seems that it has become even more pronounced, at least with regard to this intellectualism of the metropolitan lifestyle. The modern mind, he writes, has become more and more a calculating one. And we have now more or less given that job to external devices like smartphones. So it's not even our own modern mind that has become more calculating. We have gotten help from smartphones and their apps in approaching the world in this calculating, intellectualistic manner. So all of this seems to indicate a skepticism on Simmel's behalf when it comes to the metropolitan lifestyle and the culture of modernity in general. And it is certainly true that Simmel is skeptical in many ways of the metropolitan life and the modern culture as such. But one thing that I really appreciate about Simmel is that he always, in at least most texts, if not all texts, he is very careful to point out both the good and the bad stuff, so to say. So Simmel is rarely describing a phenomenon and completely condemning it as terrible, even if it seems as if he is taking a stance in the course of the text. But really, Simmel is careful to point out that each development usually comes with positive and negative strings attached. So in the Metropolis text, it becomes clear, at least to me, that he is quite concerned about this over-intellectualism that is emerging. He also speaks of a mental dullness of the blasé attitude. And I think you can tell that the fact that this blasé attitude transforms the environment from a colorful, effective, passionate, pulsating place into a place of grayscales is something that he dislikes. He is not super explicit about it, though, but judging from his work about culture and especially about his philosophy of life that he had formulated more clearly in his later works, you can at least anticipate or assume that this transformation of colorful places into gray areas or into gray places is something that he dislikes and is sort of neglecting life and the human existence as such. However, Simmel also sees some positive developments with regard to this metropolitan type or the metropolitan personality. And I think the most important one and the most pronounced one in this text is that it grants freedom to people. You can see this most clearly in the way in which he sets up this entire text, like already in the second paragraph, I believe it is. He writes about, and I quote here, "The essentially intellectualistic character of the mental life of the metropolis becomes intelligible as over against that of the small town, which rests more on feeling and emotional relationships. These latter are rooted in the unconscious levels of the mind and develop most readily in the steady equilibrium of unbroken customs. The locus of reason, on the other hand, is in the lucid, conscious upper strata of the mind, and it is the most adaptable of our inner forces." So first of all, Simmel gives away his own, say, prejudice when it comes to the body passion versus mind intellectual distinction. And he seems to say that the body and the emotional parts of human life and the passionate aspects of human life, they are somewhat untrainable or they are somewhat stuck in their development. They do not really develop much further. They are simply there and they are important and they make life sort of exciting, but you cannot really develop them any further. Against that, however, the mind and the intellectual life is very adaptable and it can evolve. And I think it speaks to the spirit of the time also, like something that has that Simmel and others have inherited from the Enlightenment philosophers, is the idea that human reason and the human mind can develop and improve. You can see this in Immanuel Kant, you can see this in Hegel, you can see this basically everywhere in all Enlightenment philosophies, in the continental context at least. There is an idea that the human mind is what is trainable and improvable. And therefore, Simmel also seems to put an emphasis on this part of human existence. And what this does for us, this potential of the mind and of reason as such, is that it allows us to create environments which can be liberating. And the Metropolis is such an example. Simmel claims somewhat wrongly, if we look at the work done by historians, that the life on the countryside and in rural areas is defined by this effective relationship. This is something we already find in Durkheim with regard to what Durkheim called the primitive societies. And I think Simmel makes a similar claim with regard to that. So they are living on the basis of empathy, on the basis of a strong community, and therefore on the basis of more like a passionate relation to each other. They like each other, they empathize with each other. This is not an intellectually thought through or legally codified, objectified existence. This is more of like a community, like in the classical sense of the word. Whereas the metropolis is a place that objectifies a lot of stuff through money, so you don't need to trust other people anymore. You don't need to rely on your empathic relationship to other people. When you make a purchase, you can rely on the currency that is in place. Or when it comes to contracts in general, or just overall interaction that is potentially harmful, you have law and legal institutions who do the job for you. So you don't need this kind of empathic or emotional relation to other people, like a trust relation, for example. You can just trust the greater installment that is in place in terms of the legal codes and the money economy on the currency which is in place, and so on and so forth. And what this does for us, says Simmel, is that it liberates us. Take money, for example. Money liberates you insofar as it makes you choose, ideally at least, where you want to purchase your stuff, where you want to buy groceries. You don't have the social pressure of buying stuff at a place where you trust the person, where you know the person, or say where your family has close relations with someone, and therefore you are, by means of your established family ties with someone, you are obliged to purchase your stuff there. Now, what you can do is you can see, okay, who provides me the best goods, the best quality for the best price? And you can pick that one. And you're not obliged to argue that you have not chosen someone else. You can simply say, well, I have made this objective calculation that this is the best quality and this is the cheapest price. Therefore, I've decided to buy my goods here or there. Or it may be, well, this shop is much closer to me, or it's easier for me to reach that because I have to just jump on the subway and I'm already there. And for the others, I have to jump on the subway and on the bus, and then I have to make a 15-minute walk. So therefore, I've chosen this place to buy my groceries in. Yeah, you're free to do that. There's nothing, potentially at least, in a rational, intellectualistic environment, there's nothing which forces you to do otherwise. Now, this is, of course, again, and then the way in which I describe it should make this obvious, this is not exactly what is happening. We know that despite this liberating aspect of money and the potential that we are completely free to choose where we buy our groceries, we still don't do that. These trust relations, these emotional relations to places, they have not vanished. They are still very much in place. And that is fine. And I think it would also be fine for Simmel that this is the case. It wouldn't really challenge his argument, because he's not saying that, well, we always act in this most objectively calculated manner. He just says that we potentially could do that. And the fact that we could do that is liberating. So in short, if you look for a clear-cut guidance whether or not modernity is a good or a bad thing, Simmel is not really providing you with a lot of guidance here. He presents a relatively balanced argument when it comes to the good and negative consequences of modernization and the culture of modernization and what it makes to human beings. I would argue, though, that based on how Simmel generally argues with regard to culture and the general undertone that he takes even in this text, he almost certainly was more of a skeptic than an optimist, even though he points to the positive aspects in terms of freedom and liberation that are attached to the development of the metropolitan and thereby the modern culture. He is generally more favorable of people like Friedrich Nietzsche, who like the emotional, affirmative, passionate side of human existence just as much, and see it threatened by the dynamics of modernity and the dynamics of industrialization, of Protestantism, or of rationalization. Simmel even sees that this is happening in the metropolitan context. He observes that the metropolis brings forth what he calls the strangest eccentricities. So in the metropolis, you can find the most eccentric people that you could possibly find in a society. And the reason for this is that the metropolitan lifestyle allows you to live a very free and therefore potentially very unique individualistic life. But at the same time, it also creates this grayscale environment, which requires a significant effort to stick out, to make your individuality observable. Thus, in order to do so, you need to be a very eccentric person. You need to somehow float above the average calculability of the general environment. You need to create a version of individuality which goes beyond something that could potentially be calculated and objectified in this intellectualistic environment. So in a strange way, the metropolis reminds people of the lack of passion, the lack of emotional affirmation, the lack of a significant portion of the human trait. And it does so by means of this very eccentric people who don't really fit in, but who serve as a constant reminder of something that has gotten lost in the metropolitan life. Thank you for listening. My name is Dominic, and I hear you next time at Chasing Society.